We have to call it for what it is, a medical apartheid. And as a result of the latest strikes on Gaza, the UN reported that 50 schools were damaged, which impacted over 40,000 children, according to Save the Children and UNRWA, the Palestinian Refugee Agency. 47,000 people have been pushed to use schools as shelters, and schools still remain closed. Israel also bombed the offices of the international press, leveling a 12-story building that used to house the offices of Al Jazeera and the Associated Press. And this is once again something that Israel does regularly. It targets journalists on purpose, Palestinian and non-Palestinian alike, because it doesn't want people to document its crimes. The situation in Gaza was already bad enough from previous wars, so bad that many things damaged in 2014 and before that have still not been rebuilt to begin with, making the effects of further Israeli aggression even more apparent. Officials in Gaza have estimated that reconstruction will cost millions of dollars and take years. Gaza's Public Works and Housing Ministry told OCHA that nearly 17,000 residential and commercial units were either damaged or completely destroyed. Around 80,000 people have either lost their homes or had their homes damaged, according to Al Jazeera. And when it comes to casualties, once again, the death toll is incomparable. The vast majority of casualties are Palestinians. In less than 2 weeks, Israel massacred 244 Palestinians. Half of those were women and children. In contrast, 12 Israelis were killed. These figures illustrate the imbalance and ruthlessness of the Israelis. According to the UN, 5,591 Palestinians have been killed versus 251 Israelis in the years between 2008 and 2020. The number of injured is also extremely disproportionate. So why is it that there are so many Palestinians killed, and why are so many of them civilians? Do the Israelis not know where their bombs are landing? Do the Israelis not know where their shells are going? Of course they do. In 2018, the Israeli occupation forces even bragged about this on Twitter, saying, quote, "We know where every bullet landed." This was during the Right to Return marches, when Palestinians were gathering at the border fence to protest, demanding to return to their homes and the homes of their parents and grandparents after they had been kicked out during the Israeli takeover and ethnic cleansing in 1948. Israel purposely shot Palestinians in the knees, killed medical staff, killed journalists, and then bragged about it. And here once again in 2021, we have a disproportionate amount of casualties on the Palestinian side, and not just casualties, but damage and destruction to public and health facilities. This is a war crime, a brazen war crime under the Geneva Convention. Israel kills 20 times more Palestinians, destroys their homes, destroys their infrastructure with overwhelming firepower, and then claims victory while also pretending it's a victim at the same time. And who is behind all this? The West, of course. The West not only gives Israel weapons and logistical support, but also political protection. After all, the United Kingdom helped create Israel when it issued the Balfour Declaration in 1917, promising a Jewish homeland in Palestine. In 1947, it gave up its mandate and left, allowing the United Nations to carve up Palestine and give Palestinians a mere 50% of their land. And Zionist militias consequently took over, and here we are. And ever since, the United States has provided weapons and other material support. Since World War II, Israel is the largest cumulative recipient of foreign aid from the U.S. Just in 2016, under Barack Obama, Israel received a $38 billion package in military aid over 10 years. That means every single year, the United States gives Israel $3.8 billion to continue bombing and killing Palestinians. Even amid all this violence, and Israeli forces desecrating Al-Aqsa Mosque, brutalizing protesters, bombing Gaza, U.S. President Joe Biden goes ahead and approves a weapons sale to the Israelis worth $735 million. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me is Max Blumenthal, journalist and editor at The Gray Zone. Thanks for coming on, Max. It's good to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
So, Max, I wanted to start out with this recent onslaught on Gaza. U.S. Secretary of State Blinken, British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, you know, they both visited Netanyahu. They're doing this kind of victory lap now. And you had all these countries groveling over Israel, just tripping over themselves to see who can support Israel the hardest. I mean, what do you make of that, right? Their support during the 11-day attack, especially from Western countries.
Well, the Biden administration entered office assuming that the Abraham Accords, the normalization of Israel with the monarchic colonial cutout states, and Jared Kushner's deal of the century were fully intact, completely safe, and that the Palestinian question or the Palestinian struggle could be put in the icebox. And they were proven wrong by this massive surge of resistance we saw across historic Palestine. Biden was forced to deal with Netanyahu, a figure who he is not necessarily sympathetic to, but this is one of the most pro-Israel former senators in the history of the Senate. And so his natural instinct was to give Israel the time it wanted. As Israel failed militarily and its domestic situation became destabilized, the Biden administration panicked. They began pushing for a ceasefire. And now we see Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, having flown to Jerusalem in the Holy Land, a place he and the Biden administration did not expect him to be at this juncture. And the program that he is offering is so out of date and out of touch with the reality on the ground. It is another call for a two-state solution and more humanitarian aid to the people of Palestine without dealing with Hamas, and more weapons for Israel. It's the same formula we've seen since the Clinton administration. So the Biden administration is stuck in 1996. And meanwhile, Hamas is at the peak of its credibility after demonstrating its deterrence capacity in this conflict, something the Biden administration and its vassals in the UK and EU are unwilling to reckon with.
And when you say Israel's military failure and that Hamas demonstrated this deterrence capability, could you maybe expand on that? Because both the Israelis and Hamas, they're both claiming victory, right? But there seems to be a clear winner here, and not just militarily at least, but I would also say in public opinion.
Well, in terms of public opinion, the clear victor is Hamas. And this escalation occurred right after Mahmoud Abbas, the sort of permanent ruler of the West Bank cantons and collaborator with the Israeli security forces, had postponed indefinitely the Palestinian Legislative Council elections. So Hamas not only showed itself to be a representative of the Palestinian polity, but also a defender of Jerusalem and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site in Islam. So As far as the political metrics, Hamas appears to be the clear winner. Militarily, each side measures its victory in a different way. Israel obviously can destroy much more, but this escalation was not a war that can be looked at in isolation. It's a part of a series of wars that have occurred since the siege of Gaza began in 2005. And so it's a protracted war, and in each escalation, Hamas and the armed factions in the Gaza Strip, Islamic Jihad, PFLP, have demonstrated their ability to improve their capacity to strike deeper into Israeli territory. This time, Hamas broke out of Gaza, actually affected the situation in Jerusalem, and broke through Israel's Iron Dome, striking targets. It orchestrated set-piece attacks over Tel Aviv, something we've never seen before. It cleared the frontiers of Gaza from Israeli military equipment vehicles with its Cornet anti-tank guided missiles. It terrified the Israeli military to the point where Israel faked a ground invasion, something that had gone fairly wrong during the last assault on Gaza in 2014, and it outsmarted Israel when Israel attempted to trick Hamas leadership and Hamas military leadership into going into bunkers and the tunnel system under Gaza City by not falling for that feint. So Israel's major military maneuver actually failed. What Israel achieved turned out to be the destruction of civilian towers, which, as an Air Force pilot revealed, was just an act of frustration, a ventilation of the bloodlust of Israeli society, and the killing of many families, removing entire families from the civil registry through massacres. This was Israel's military achievement, and this speaks to another political failure of Israel, or connects to another political failure of Israel we can discuss more in length, which is its loss of the global opinion battle.
Just recently, Egypt has invited Hamas, the PA, and Israel for peace talks, you know, to try and forge a more sustainable truce. What do you think of that? What do you think the outcome of that is going to be?
In each case, Israel has refused to offer anything directly to Hamas and has worked through Egypt, which is emerging more and more as a broker between Hamas and the West, and Qatar. And the agenda has always been that Qatar will inject enough money to keep the status quo going, and slowly Hamas will be domesticated. And that's what Israel believed had happened in the past 7 years, and Hamas demonstrated that that was not in the cards whatsoever. So I think we're going to see more demands from the governors of the Gaza Strip, and they're going to make those demands not just based on the removing the siege from Gaza or improving conditions in Gaza, but also they will be related to the home thefts in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem. They will be related to the status quo around the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They'll be related to the overall occupation. And that is going to be a new development. And we saw Yahya Sinwar, the prime minister of the Gaza Strip, deliver a press conference in front of the public and then declare to the Israeli military that he was walking home, walked through the Gaza City and said, if you want to find me, I will be at home, daring them to assassinate him as he was a top target during this escalation. He understands that Hamas has deterred Israel to the point that they will not be assassinating him in the near future.
Yeah, it's quite an astonishing victory. It's quite a shift from what we've seen before. And, you know, just lastly, Max, I saw you wrote this article in The Gray Zone, you know, about this this PR campaign where they're trying to portray pro-Palestinian supporters as anti-Semitic. You know, I was wondering if you wanted to expand on that or tell us a bit more about it.
Well, it was inevitable that the Israel lobby in the U.S., after this massive political defeat, after seeing just this unprecedented surge of Palestine solidarity activism in the streets, with protests in places we've never seen protests before, like Pensacola, Florida, big protest in Las Vegas, a large protest in Kansas City, in a country they thought they had on lock, that they would invent a wave of anti-Semitic hate attacks by misrepresenting and distorting video of scuffles between pro-Israel fanatics who were provoking or even physically assaulting Palestine Solidarity demonstrators in the streets of New York. And so what I did was basically analyze the video, show how it was deceptively edited, reveal, for example, that a young man who said he was attacked wearing a Jewish skull cap or a kippah in Midtown New York was not actually wearing one. The photos show him wearing a hoodie. There was no way of determining that he was Jewish, and showing that those Palestine Solidarity demonstrators who did attack him were actually being provoked and assaulted themselves prior to that. So the Israel lobby is trying to create the specter of anti-Semitism to paint the Jewish public as the ultimate victims of this brutal assault on the Gaza Strip. And at the same time, they're doing what they did in the UK, which is to fabricate or to paint Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party, a veteran anti-racist, as a racist anti-Semite. But what they're doing is they're making us all Jeremy Corbyn. They're painting an entire movement as anti-Semitic in a bid to criminalize it. And it's important for people to not fall for it, because we see, like, progressives in Congress, including Ilhan Omar. We've seen Code Pink issue statements condemning the rise in anti-Semitism. And they are essentially condemning something that has been manufactured by an enemy that seeks to criminalize and remove them from public life. So it's important to call it out for what it is, to be clinical and forensic in analyzing these incidents. And that's what I've done at the Gray Zone and what we'll continue to do.
After 11 days of relentless bombings against Gaza, Israel claimed that it had emerged victorious. This is something that Israel always does for propaganda purposes, even when it's not true. One also wonders how it's possible to speak of victory when half the people Israel kills are not even combatants, but civilians. In 2006, during the war against Lebanon, the Israelis also claimed victory, even though Hezbollah sent them running with advanced weaponry and equipment provided by Iran. Maybe Netanyahu has been victorious in keeping his political rivals at bay and stopping any hopes of a coalition from happening without him, which would put an end to his 12-year rule. Now, he might hold on to power just a little bit longer because, of course, attacking Palestine is always an easy way to unite Zionists under one common banner and distract everyone from internal shortcomings like Netanyahu's corruption scandal or his inability to form a coalition. Now, Netanyahu's claims that he has set back Hamas or deterred them in any way are so outlandish that even other Israelis do not believe him. As history shows, Israel can only ever last a few days at war. It does not have the means to do anything else except maintain an illegal occupation. And this is true of almost every single conflict. Hamas was able to launch over 4,000 rockets, which reached as far as Tel Aviv. They were able to fire more rockets at a much higher rate and up to ranges of 250 kilometers. Their firepower is no joke, and it's thanks to Iran's support for the resistance that they're able to fend off Zionist aggression. Palestinians celebrated the ceasefire all over Gaza, flying flags and taking to the streets. And various Hamas officials thanked Iran for its unwavering support for Palestine and for the resistance. Public opinion worldwide has begun to shift. Hundreds of thousands of people have come out to protest in London. People took to the streets in support of Gaza all over the world, including France, Germany, Spain, Canada, and many more countries where we wouldn't have seen protests before. And although Western governments in general support Israel, the media's pro-Israeli narrative is beginning to lift, and more people are starting to see the reality behind what is happening in Palestine, that it's not just some random conflict, but an occupation. People see the disproportion in force. They see the wrath that Israel unleashes on Palestinians, and they know right from wrong. And in a first for Europe, Ireland's parliament passed a motion condemning the Israeli occupation and recognizing that its occupation of Palestinian land is a de facto annexation. So who emerged victorious from this 11-day assault? The Israelis think they did. And sure, if you think bombing roads and killing children and destroying infrastructure is winning, then yes, Israel won the war crimes contest. Israel claims that it dealt Hamas a huge blow. But this is just a safe face. Of course, Israel has a more advanced military and bigger bombs. And what does it do with those things? Military occupation and ethnic cleansing. You think that's something to be proud of? That's disgusting. And the Israelis know it's disgusting, which is why they spend so much time trying to hide their crimes from the world and using their lobby to silence criticism and cover up their occupation and war crimes in Palestine. If people knew what Israel does and understood the reality that Palestinians must live through, they would be mortified, and rightfully so. The Palestinian people have resilience, and they will never allow the Israelis to defeat them, whether in war or in occupation. Palestinians have never been on a level playing field. They have always been at a disadvantage, yet they resist. They do not have planes, tanks, ships, nor nuclear weapons, yet they resist. They are bombed, killed, oppressed, and massacred, yet they resist. Almost the entire world has abandoned Palestine, and yet they still resist. People need to understand something about Palestinians and the Middle East in general. You cannot beat people on their own home turf. At the end of the day, this occupation is taking place in Palestine. This is Palestinian land, and Palestinians will never give it up. They will fight to the death and even beyond because they know that what they fight for is sacred. They know the value of this earth, this land, their homes, their religions, their people, and their culture. They will not be defeated. The same for Yemenis, the same for Syrians, the same for Iranians and for Lebanese. This is why we talk about al-muqawami, the resistance, because we resist occupation and imperialism together. And no amount of Israeli propaganda or Western media lies will ever change that. So long as Palestine and Palestinians exist, then they are victorious. Israel will never win ultimately because it cannot defeat the Palestinian people and their resolve. Palestinians, along with Yemenis, Syrians, and many others in the Middle East, they all know what they fight for. They fight for their lives. They fight for their land. They fight for their homes. They fight for their families and their neighbors. They fight for their very right to exist. They know the real value and the worth of what lies beneath their feet. They do not have dual nationalities or two homes or the ability to go wherever they want, like the settler colonialists and Zionists who have come to occupy their land and shamelessly rob Palestinians of their homes. Palestinians do not have those luxuries or billions of dollars every year in military aid or the full backing of the West or the mainstream media to cover for them. For Palestinians, this is a matter of life and death. This is existential, and this is why they will never give up and why they can never be defeated. Thanks for tuning in, and long live the resistance. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The recovery policies of some G7 nations threw major lifelines to the oil and gas industry, risking an increase in the production and locking of these energy systems for decades, says Julia Conley Ryder in an article published under the heading. Despite green recovery vows, G7 nations spent billions more on fossil fuels than renewables over the past year. Stay tuned for more. Even as officials prepare for the G7 summit, where seven of the world's richest nations will reportedly discuss climate action and a green recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic, a new report reveals that those same countries poured tens of billions of dollars more into fossil fuels in the last year than they spent supporting renewable energy. According to the relief agency Tier Fund, the International Institute for Sustainable Development, IISD, and the Overseas Development Institute, ODI, the G7 nations invested $189 billion in fossil fuel production and deregulation between January 2020 and March 2021, while committing just $147 billion to developing renewable energy. The group report titled Cleaning Up Their Act notes that, in most cases, the money invested by the US, the UK, Japan, France, Germany, Italy, and Canada was spent without green strings, which would have conditioned the spending on fossil fuel companies' commitment to climate action. The said countries missed major opportunities to make their response to COVID-19 greener, the report reads. More than 8 in every $10 committed to fossil fuels came with no green strings attached. Investments with no green strings attached are highly problematic, as they end up benefiting fossil fuel-intensive activities without requirements for any climate targets or reductions in pollution, said Angela Piccarello, Senior Research Officer at ODI. Despite promises to build back better after the pandemic by U.S. President Joe Biden, who adopted the slogan for his 2020 campaign and other leaders, the U.S. and Canadian governments rolled back fossil fuel regulations in the last year, including waiving requirements for impact assessments for infrastructure projects, suspending penalties for pollution-causing corporations, and extending deadlines for emissions reporting. The emissions of already developed reserves of oil, gas, and coal alone could bring the world beyond plus 1.5 degrees Celsius warming limits set by the Paris Agreement, the report states. Yet the recovery policies of some G7 nations threw major lifelines to the oil and gas industry, risking an increase in the production and locking of these energy systems for decades. G7 nations particularly invested in transportation systems that run on fossil fuels, spending $115 billion on bailouts for companies including Air France, British Airways, and Honda. More than 80% of the funds were given to the companies without securing commitments to reduce emissions, according to the report. So much for the green recovery, tweeted Nick Taylor, a lecturer at the Political Economy Research Center in London. The report comes days after G7 leaders announced their plans to discuss significant steps to mitigate the climate crisis at the summit, which begins on June 11th in Cornwall, England. The officials will reportedly discuss phasing out new direct government support for international fossil fuels, conserving 30% of land by 2030 to boost biodiversity and help absorb carbon emissions, and other measures. The G7 actions since the pandemic began, however, have left advocates questioning leaders' commitment to the green recovery they have spent the last year promising. While 8 out of 11 countries substantially improved the greenness of their plans over the last year at the time of writing only 4, Canada, France, Germany, and the UK have developed plans that will cause more environmental good than harm, the report reads. A G7 summit where leaders take seriously the need to invest in renewable energy rather than fossil fuels, said ODI, could also lay groundwork for a successful COP26, which is taking place in November in Scotland. Every year, we witness the worsening consequences of the climate crisis for communities around the world. Farmers' crops failing, floods and fires engulfing towns and villages, families facing an uncertain future, said Paul Cook, the head of the advocacy at Tier Fund. He added, choices made now by the G7 countries will either accelerate the transition towards a climate-safe future for all or jeopardize efforts to date to tackle the climate crisis.
The world with reporters.
The world's shoulders Hundreds of British pro-Palestine activists amassed outside a notorious arms manufacturer near Blackburn on Friday, demanding an end to Israeli arms sales. Anger was vented in various ways, including with a funeral procession honoring the recent martyrdom of over 60 children slain in Gaza.
It's a genocide that's occurring before our eyes. Companies like BAE Systems are complicit in what's going on there. They're providing illegal weaponry.
Now they've been exposed, the Zionist regime, because from footage from underground, from Gaza, has come out. And people are starting to realize that this is an apartheid, ethnic cleansing, colonialism regime that is operating, and it has to end.
Today, we came here to send a message to the world. What is the mistake of these children? 64 children have been killed, innocent. Some of them were sleeping in the hands of their parents, and they found themselves dead. Why? One, the answer is occupation. In the occupation, everything will be sorted out.
BAE Systems is one of Britain's biggest arms dealers and is known for building weapons used by Middle Eastern regimes to target innocent civilians in conflict zones.
Essentially here to register our protest and say to BAE Systems and to the government that this is simply unacceptable, that weapons manufactured here in Lancashire, here in England, should be used against civilians in Gaza and in Palestine.
This is the second week that local residents have come in good numbers to condemn BAE Systems, and more action is being planned. Major arms firms such as this have been heavily criticized many times in the past. However, it's very rare for protest movements of this size and frequency to engage in such regular and very direct action. Now, these locals are coming out in numbers, hoping to force a change which will inevitably save lives in places like Palestine and elsewhere too. Robert Carter, Blackburn.
With only less than 2 weeks to go before Iran's presidential elections, the seven candidates have expressed their views and plans in conferences, TV programs, and interviews. Some have criticized the current economic policies, while others pledged to make some fundamental reforms if elected. Mohsen Mehralizadeh said he would seek de-escalation between Iran and other countries, noting that the government should not let for some factors to detach the country from the rest of the world. He also pledged to form a cabinet made of experienced people who are able to solve people's problems. Ebrahim Raisi pledged to do his utmost to end the corruption in the country. He also pointed out the issue of unemployment as a major problem young Iranians are struggling with. He vowed to help the youth with their employment and housing problems. Raisi stressed that his first priority would be people's livelihoods and welfare. Alireza Zakani, who is currently serving as a parliament member, said he would seek a comprehensive progress of the country. He also criticized Iran's current foreign policy and stressed that the country's foreign policy should serve the economy, culture, society, politics, and security by taking a broader horizon into consideration. Former Central Bank Governor Abdel Nasser Himmati said he is a reformist and his main agenda is economic reforms. He called on Iranians to support him with their votes. Himmati noted the mass COVID-19 vaccination would be his first plan after winning the race. Another candidate, Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi, said his main goal is to support the people by reducing household expenses and increasing purchasing power. He also pledged to eliminate economic rent-seeking and lessen the government's interference in the process of production, imports, and distribution of goods. Former top nuclear negotiator Saeed Jalili called for a strategy in which people can observe and monitor the performance of the government. However, he called on Iranian people not to wait for anyone and continue their efforts towards the development of the country, regardless of who is going to win the presidential race. Mohsen Rezaei criticized former and current administrations for adopting wrong economic policies. Rezaei said such measures have caused economic hardships Iranians have been dealing with for years. The 66-year-old hopeful also called for unity among Iranians in order to be able to overcome the economic crisis.
It's squalid accommodation that was not fit to house human beings fleeing persecution. That was how lawyers representing six asylum seekers described Napier military barracks in Kent in a case brought to the British High Court. In a landmark ruling, Mr. Justice Lyndon agreed and said all of them were
vulnerable victims of trafficking and or torture who experienced a deterioration in their mental health as a result of their accommodation at Napier Barracks.
Napier Barracks has turned into a resident site for vulnerable asylum seekers despite a warning from Public Health England that the dormitories were not suitable accommodation during a pandemic. However, the court found that this advice was not followed, leading to a COVID outbreak infecting half the residents.
The Home Office responded to the ruling with this statement.
Throughout this period, our accommodation providers and subcontractors have made improvements to the site and continue to do so. It is disappointing that this judgment was reached on the basis of the site prior to the significant improvement works which have taken place in difficult circumstances. Napier will continue to operate and provide safe and secure accommodation. We will carefully consider the ruling and our next steps.
Human rights campaigner Adam Yassir came to the UK as a refugee from Darfur in Sudan. He's been supporting asylum seekers who've been staying at Napier Barracks and gave a witness testimony to the High Court.
Multiple asylum seekers asked me to provide a noise cancellation earplugs, and I asked, and they say, the guys say to me, some people scream at night, they've got PTSD.
Calls are mounting for the Home Office to shut down the controversial barracks after a damning court ruling found that they had acted unlawfully and irrationally, which could potentially lead to damages against the British Home Secretary, Priti Patel.
I felt they've been used to send message to other asylum seekers, people who are trying to seek safety and security in the UK. But it is the wrong way. It is breaking the law to make a point. It's not the right way, and it isn't working at all. It isn't working. Hence, someone needs to be accountable, and the Home Secretary should actually consider her position.
The ruling by the High Court will be a vindication for lawyers, rights groups and activists alike, who for too long have had their concerns regarding Napier Barracks ignored. But they will still feel their fight is far from over, while asylum seekers still remain housed there in what the court described as appalling conditions. Ahmed Cabella, London.
In a year not short of drama, the British royal family is embroiled in yet another scandal. Claims of historical racism. Unearthing documents in the UK National Archives, The Guardian has revealed palace officials ban, quote, colored immigrants or foreigners from serving in clerical roles in the royal household until at least the late 1960s. Instead, they were permitted to work as domestic servants.
In the optics of what the royal family has been about, I mean, just a knowledge of history would tell you that it's a highly racialized institution. And regardless of the fact that the Queen runs a Commonwealth, which is a majority of minority ethnic background vis-a-vis the Brits, that would be black and so on, it doesn't surprise me at all.
The ban was eventually ended, but Buckingham Palace has refused to say when, only that its records show employment of ethnic minorities started in the 1990s and that it did not keep records on staff members' race from the decades prior. The archive documents also reveal Queen Elizabeth II has been exempt from race and gender equality laws since their introduction in the kingdom in the 1970s, prohibiting individuals working for her household from suing on discrimination grounds. That exception remains in place to this day.
What is happening is that across the world, people are taking a different view of the royal family. And as she is in charge of the Commonwealth, it does not bode well for the future of the Commonwealth at all.
The new findings come on the heels of allegations earlier this year of racism within the ranks of the royal family from two of its members.
And also concerns and conversations about how dark his skin might be when he's born.
And of silence and denials from other members.
Very much not a racist man.
This week, the Queen will be marking a huge annual spectacle celebrating decades of her reign. Will the new revelations put a damper on the British monarch's so-called platinum jubilee? Saeedpur is up, London.
The race for the top executive post in Iran rages on among the seven candidates who appear before reporters every day. to outline their plans. Plans for a brighter future, stronger economy, and more opportunities for the youth. So journalists rarely ask contenders about what they have done in the past, but what they will do should they win the election.
The first move that my administration will focus on is to uproot poverty in the first year. If poverty is eliminated, our people will excel in culture and enlightenment.
I will pay special attention to the youth and their problems. Unemployment is now the first and foremost issue of our youth. As an economist, I believe that if we remove the uncertainty in our market, we can easily create jobs. Also, I will allow young experts to run at least 50% of my cabinet.
All of the candidates have so far spoken of problems that they blame on the incumbent government. Problems that range from inflation to unemployment. Some of the contenders find the root cause of these problems in the fact that outgoing President Rouhani has put all his eggs in the basket of the 2015 nuclear deal, which is now hanging by a thread.
Nobody can ignore the negative effects of the sanctions on our economy. But at the same time, we cannot reach out to our enemy and appeal to them to lift the sanctions. This method has not worked and will not work. We cannot pin hope on the lifting of sanctions to fix our economy. We should have relied on our own domestic capacities to have a resilient economy.
This year, the coronavirus pandemic has curtailed election rallies and electoral tours. Based on the guidelines set by the Coronavirus Combat Committee, campaigns are conducted through televised debates between candidates, feature documentaries, and speeches. Campaigning will continue until 24 hours before Election Day on June 18th. The Islamic Republic holds an average of one election each year since its establishment in 1979. Now candidates call on Iranians to turn up en masse for this year's election, as in the previous rounds, since high voter turnout is translated into a seal of approval for the legitimacy of the Islamic establishment. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yair Lapid, the leader of Israeli opposition Yesh Atid party, informed the Israeli president that he can form a coalition cabinet. This brings to an end the era of long-time Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Under the coalition agreement, Lapid will share power with head of the right-wing Yamina, Naftali Bennett, who would be Netanyahu's immediate replacement. For the Palestinians, however, Netanyahu's removal would be no improvement, especially that the coming Prime Minister Bennett, who was a former settler leader, rejects Palestinian statehood. Palestinian officials say they expect Bennett's cabinet will even be more extreme than Netanyahu's.
For us, this coalition cabinet that was declared to replace Netanyahu's radical cabinet is even more radical when it comes to Israel's policies towards Palestinians. It will seek to expand settlements in the occupied lands. We trust none of Israeli parties. Their policy towards Palestinians won't be different.
Experts say that for the time being, Netanyahu's successors with their disparate agendas are expected to leave contentious issues unresolved. According to them, Bennett doesn't believe in a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. His aim instead is to take full control of Palestinians. Moreover, they say, Bennett has some red lines he will never cross. He has long championed the right of settlement in the West Bank.
There's a consensus among all far-right parties when it comes to policies towards Palestinians. The two parties have already agreed to keep Area C of the West Bank under their control, which makes up almost 58% of the West Bank. The new cabinet will press ahead with the annexation plan, which is part of the so-called deal of the century.
Under the coalition agreement, Bennett and Lapid would rotate the role of prime minister, with Bennett taking up the post for the first 2 years and Lapid the final two.
Experts say Netanyahu will not let it go easily, as the parliament still has about 12 days to swear in the cabinet. During this period, Netanyahu will do his utmost to convince enough right-wing lawmakers to vote against the new cabinet. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
To discuss the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, the Swedish Minister of Foreign Affairs, Ann Linde, met with the head of Yemen's negotiating delegation participating in peace talks in Oman's capital, Muscat, Mohammed Abdel Salam said the blockade in Yemen goes against international law, and Yemenis have the right to access food, medicine and fuel, even under the ongoing war.
Sweden is one of the countries that support peace in Yemen and hosted talks between the warring sides in Stockholm back in 2018. This confirms Sweden's desire to find a permanent and comprehensive solution for Yemenis. Mohammed Abdel Salam affirmed the same stance, which is the stance of all Yemenis who demand the lifting of the blockade and the entry of the oil ships. This will open a window to a fair political solution for both parties.
Abdel Salam stated that Yemenis have welcomed any effort toward lifting the siege in their country and reaching a ceasefire. He added that no serious steps have been taken for ending the humanitarian crisis in his country, which means no serious steps have been taken in other areas.
The meeting that took place between Mohammed Abdel Salam and the Swedish Foreign Affairs Minister confirms the right of the Yemeni people to obtain oil, food and medicine and have the blockade lifted. These demands are in accordance with the character of the United Nations. The humanitarian crisis should not be linked to the military operations taking place on the ground. We are open to any negotiations, but with preserving the rights of the Yemeni people, the first of which is stopping the siege.
For weeks now, Oman's capital, Muscat, has been hosting fresh rounds of talks between the warring sides of Yemen. So far, the talks have failed in finding a peaceful solution to the years-long Saudi war on Yemen that has pushed the country to the brink of famine.
Lifting the siege has always been the main demand of all Yemenis who are looking forward to the end of their suffering. However, they say they are afraid that the war continues as the last round of negotiations has not yet yielded any results. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The fifth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA concludes in Vienna. The objective, to bring the US back into the deal and to ensure the full implementation of Iran's nuclear commitments. EU coordinator Enrico Mora said the sticking points are fewer than they were a week ago.
It's a complex process with political decisions, with rather technical issues. They go in parallel. Now we are reaching a point in which we have to face the hard decisions. That's why it's only logical that head of delegations will go back to capitals. They will expose to their authorities the situation, and they will come back, I hope, with new, fresh ideas to finally close the negotiations.
Iranian lead delegate Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said although the sides have made good progress, some key issues still need to be resolved. Iran has demanded the removal of all sanctions imposed, reimposed or relabeled under the former US administration, saying it will only return to full compliance after the verification of sanctions removal.
It is certainly the other side who has to make difficult decisions. What we need to do at the same time is on the implementation plans, decide on the methods and ways which meet our interest most. But for the US, for the other side, for Europeans, it is time to make difficult decisions. And I hope that they would be able to do that.
The Joint Commission will meet again in a week's time, and though the EU coordinator said he is absolutely sure the next round will be the last, Iran's lead delegate opted for a more cautious stance, saying that nothing can be predicted in such difficult negotiations. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
The European Commission reports that 45% of adults in the EU have now received their first dose of COVID-19 vaccine. In its latest budget policy recommendations under Economic Semester 2021, the Commission claims the vaccine rollout is providing hope.
Restrictions are being eased, and also more affected sectors are gradually again opening for business.
There is no official data available yet, but it is clear that right across the EU, businesses allowed to reopen in recent weeks simply have not. government funding to support businesses while they were closed and financial support to keep jobs afloat is now being cut. This means the true scale of the economic crisis in the EU is very unclear at the moment. The bloc is on course, though, to vaccinate most adults before September the 1st. However, economists say that will not prove to be the proverbial silver bullet. Getting things back to how they were prior to COVID-19 will take years, they warn. Concern persists over the possibility that, as they emerge, new strains of COVID-19 might be resistant to existing vaccines.
Uncertainty is still high. We do not yet know what lasting effects crisis will leave and also the exact impact of the recovery and resilience facility.
Even before we get to learn about the real data in the coming months, things are already bad.
The youth unemployment rate remains more than double the average unemployment rate.
Experts say the EU needs to focus much more on creating quality jobs for young people.
The European Union definitely needs to continue working and invest more money on young people. This is definitely a crucial point. As you also said, we are the future of the population in Europe.
There is massive government and personal debt in the EU. The European Commission has announced it will not enforce austerity on the 27 member states until 2023. The question is, how will citizens be impacted when that does start happening again? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on June 4, 2014, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of the demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine.
As for the first part, the reality that I referred to is that 25 years have passed from the demise of our great Imam, Rahmatullah Alayhi. But people's enthusiasm and excitement to hear and know about him has not diminished. And this is not particular to our country. Rather, this reality exists in the world of Islam and even beyond that. Not only in our country, where the third generation of revolution is growing and blossoming, but also in the entire world of Islam, the youth of the age of communications and internet are after gaining more information about the issues of the revolution, about the Islamic Republic, and about the architect of this great structure. and these youths can easily familiarize themselves with these issues which occur far away from their own environment. The phenomenon of religious democracy and the theory of Wilayat-e Faqih are issues which are significant and attractive for the intellectual environments of the world of Islam. From the first days, our enemies began making a comprehensive effort, and the more we moved forward, the more comprehensive this effort became. They used hundreds and thousands of televisions, radio stations, and internet sites to abuse the Islamic Republic, its great founder, and its supporters. Of course, this issue has been helpful to us because it has aroused the curiosity of listeners and viewers throughout the world. These listeners and viewers want to know the reason behind all these enmities, hostilities, and mudslinging. They want to know the nature of the truth, which has been the target of these enmities. So our enemies mentioned our names, and they spoke about Imam Rahmatullah Alayh and our system with the purpose of showing their enmity. But surely they will scheme, and I too will scheme. The Holy Quran, chapter 86, verse 15 and 16. This is what Allah the Exalted says. They started this widespread movement with such an intention, but it eventually created an opportunity for us because the sense of curiosity of the listeners to these stations was aroused throughout the world.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. The illegal recycling of electronics is a toxic business on a global scale. Every year, 3/4 of electronic waste from Europe and the U.S. disappears from official recycling system and is shipped illegally to India, China, or Africa. In the first part of the documentary, we took you on an investigative journey through Africa, China, Europe, and the U.S. in an effort to unravel the out-of-control corrupt systems enabling illegal e-waste recycling. Stay with us as we further investigate to reveal the apparatus of large-scale trafficking as well as a complex chain of responsibility and collusion in the next part of the program.
The U.S. is the only country in the world, apart from Haiti, that has not ratified the Basel Convention, the international agreement banning the export of toxic waste. To make matters worse, the U.S. government itself is as bad as anyone else when it comes to recycling its own discarded equipment.
The U.S. government is the single
biggest producer of electronic waste on the planet.
Discarded electronics of whole departments are routinely put out to public auction instead of being sent to trustworthy recyclers.
Whoever gives the government the best rate, in other words, they can take it for free or almost for free, the government is kind of obliged to do that because in our laws you're supposed to go the cheapest way to save the taxpayer money. But the cheapest way is the dirtiest way.